I don't know about you, but I'm incredible at multitasking. I'm live on the MIC from here at KCUR Studios while I'm simultaneously chatting with my brother, emailing my producer, calling my mom, watching an episode of The Office, plus some baking a cake. Yeah, I'm just that bad at what I do. I mean, good. Did I say bad? Uh-oh, I must be burning my cake. What have I done? I'm Jabulani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, a lesson in being mindful with Dr. Bruce Leese. He says enemy number one of mindfulness is, that's right, multitasking. That's all ahead on Central Standard, demanding your undivided attention, whatever that is, after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. In any London subway station, you'll see the warning, "Mind the gap." It means look out, be aware for the space between the platform and the train car. Likewise, my grandfather used to say, "Boy, mind your mama," which means pay attention to her instructions. In both of these cases, there are consequences for not being mindful. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabulani LaFall. Today, we welcome Dr. Bruce Leese, a professor of family medicine at KU, to help us explore the concept of mindfulness in our daily lives. Dr. Leese, welcome to the show once again.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
What does it mean to be mindful? Define it for us.
It means paying attention in the present moment right now to what's going on, not dividing up one's own attention, learning to focus well, not being distracted, certainly not multitasking.
The whole mind the gap explanation that I gave.
Don't be reading a book while you get on the train and right. Fall through.
Talk about mindfulness as a cognitive therapy, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, and how it works.
All good therapies, cognitive therapy, all of the good therapies that exist help people to focus very specifically on problems that are of concern to them. We go about life doing so many different things that often what we should be paying attention to, problems, for example, never get our full attention. So any good therapy, even a good visit to a doctor who's listening well, will be therapy in that it will get a person's mind focused on what really matters in the moment as the clinician or the person asking the question asks those questions.
From where does the concept of mindfulness originate? Where do we first find out about this concept? Where does it come from?
It comes from Eastern religions, predominantly Hinduism, Buddhism. The Eastern religions, 2,500 years ago or more, started out by trying to figure out what caused pain and suffering in life. The effort to eliminate that pain and suffering or reduce it got these great philosophers, these great spiritualists to start really sitting down and thinking. So it began with spiritual traditions and has run the gamut. And all when you hear the term mystical relating to a religion, whether it's Catholicism, Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, all of those religions, those practitioners who go to mysticism are working towards mindfulness and meditation and those kinds of techniques.
Did some of these practitioners, these ancient practitioners that brought it forth to modern times, did they find that suffering has its roots in wanting to be in control or being out of your mind? Talk about that.
Yeah, they actually, in both Hinduism and Buddhism, there is that concept of attachment, being stubbornly attached to an idea or an object or even a person. So attachment is the cause of all suffering according to those traditions. And the assumption is that everything on the planet is temporary. So attachment to anything can cause great suffering and emotional distress.
It sure can. And we know this for sure through experience. How do you practice being mindful, and what are the long-term implications of being mindful?
One of the ways I practice being mindful is I set myself up for doing things like this morning with you, knowing that I have a commitment to being here. I know that I need to spend a certain amount of time in preparation, really concentrating on the topic, really not letting myself get distracted as I prepare. If I were, if I were an astronaut, I'd be very mindful as I prepare for, my flight into space. It's the way I prepare for or become mindful is to know that I have a responsibility, and the only way I'm going to succeed at that responsibility is by staying focused. In general, people that have difficulty focusing can learn things like meditation or through yoga, use those kinds of exercises, standardized exercises, to learn to stay focused, to be in the moment.
Can or should we be practicing being mindful before starting a task, for instance, before coming to work or before starting any given task in the day?
Optimally, I don't do this, but optimally, it's a great idea every day to start out. Some people say their prayers in the morning. Some people meditate. Some people exercise. I don't do any of those every single day of my life, but it's a terrific idea to get centered, to get focused. I hear in my practice, I hear a lot of people say, I think I have attention deficit disorder. Concentrating and being mindful and being present and focused are hard work. And people underestimate the degree to which they have to prepare for that hard work, that focus, or the degree to which they have to pull their mind back to focusing. So starting out the day that way is a good idea, but so is just an awareness that, no, it's not necessarily attention deficit disorder. It's just part of being a human being. And people just underestimate how much work it is.
And is it part of the culture as well for people to maybe find it cute to be aloof, like, oh, I have attention deficit disorder, when they really don't have the full diagnosis, but just the nature of having to do a whole bunch of things at once?
Oh, people joke about it so much.
It's the butt of a joke, yeah.
Well, I have acquaintances and even a friend or two over the years who've said it to me, and I kind of went, ha-ha. That's cute. And they said, no, I really have it. And so it's hard to know who really has it and who doesn't from a social interaction, because some people joke about it and some people really at least claim to have it. And I do think the phenomenon exists, but not nearly as pervasively. The disorder is not nearly as pervasively as one might think.
What are the risks of not being mindful?
I'm tempted to give you a superficial answer. I will, and then I'll take it from there. You can get a speeding ticket. You can get in a car wreck. I say superficial because anything that we learn to do automatically that we don't have to concentrate on, even walking downstairs, anything we do that we do automatically because it's habitual or overlearned, as the same as habitual, any of those things are likely to get us less mindful, because we think, oh, I don't need to really think about this drive. I do it every day. I know which streets to turn on. So once people become mindless or unfocused on the task, there's the risk of doing everything and anything wrong, accidents. In the interpersonal context, there's the potential for slighting people. Within the past hour, I was talking to a friend who had something going on and was looking at their cell phone while they were talking to me. And you said, what are the risks? One risk, a minor risk perhaps, is that people will think you're not interested in them. You're too busy for them. You don't really care about what they're saying if it's that kind of a distraction or non-mindfulness.
It's interesting that you say there are superficial consequences such as a speeding ticket or a car wreck, but these are events that could potentially change your life.
Right. When I say superficial, I guess what I mean is I'm giving you the specific without giving you the real underlying loss. I mean, there have been interesting studies on multitasking that talk about the hundreds of thousands of hours that have been lost in employee productivity. And you're right. A car wreck is not a minor event. But, we could avoid car wrecks and speeding tickets just by being mindful. And it seems like such a a small expectation on people.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Dr. Bruce Lisa, professor of family medicine at KU, is here discussing the concept of mindfulness in our daily lives. Kansas City, how has not being mindful gotten you into trouble before? What's your trick for mindfulness? How do you employ mindfulness in your daily life? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also shoot us an email at centralstandard.org. Already on Facebook, Punk Johnny Cash walked the line and told us meditation made him more mindful. Reading Buddhist scriptures inspired that mindfulness. Thank you, Punk Johnny Cash from Facebook. Also on Facebook, Sandy recommends BJ Fogg, Tiny Habits. BJ Fogg is the director of the Persuasive Lab at Stanford University. His book is called Tiny Habits and pushes out one of the autopilot that most people live on. So that's what Sandy recommends, Tiny Habits and the autopilot that most people live on. Talk about multitasking. You alluded to that several times earlier in this conversation, Dr. Lees. It's something that all of us try to do in this fast-paced society. Is multitasking a mindful thing to undertake?
I was thinking earlier, there's multitasking where an individual who has a whole bunch of, you know, kind of mechanical behaviors they have to take care of. Like I was a chef when I was a younger man, and you know I was required to cook, you know, 4, 5, 6, 10 different fast foods at once, and you know there was definitely multitasking going on, but it was with automatic behaviors where there was where I had a system and. You know, it was all cooking, although it was different kinds of cooking, deep fryer, grill, et cetera. So I was multitasking, but those were really automatic behaviors, and all of them required a system. In any kind of interpersonal process, like you and me talking, if you do anything but engage me, it's going to distract me and disrupt our conversation to some extent. One of the reasons I like working with you is you always seem so focused on our discussion. Technology draws people away from the task at hand. They choose to, to message each other. They choose to be distracted by ringing phones. So much of technology has the potential to pull somebody out of an interpersonal one-on-one experience that's certainly pervasive. And having raised a child, kids are encouraged to have TV on by their friends because their friends say, oh, did you see that show? No, I was doing homework. Well, why can't you do both? So multitasking starts in childhood. It can be all different forms of technology operating at once. Texting, being on the computer, maybe Facebook, and simultaneously having TV on and doing homework is not uncommon in a young person. And it's an awful habit, and it goes into adulthood, like driving and texting or driving and getting on the phone.
You say it's an awful habit, but isn't it also the new normal? Isn't it no longer sort of impolite to check your phone while out to dinner? Isn't that almost a social norm? It's a social norm on the fringe, but it's almost a social norm.
Oh, it is the social norm. I remember my first cell phone. It was a big bag with a phone that weighed a few pounds. And if that had rung at a dinner table, particularly in a restaurant, and I had taken that out, people would have carted me away.
Yeah, you'd have been the man of the hour for that.
They probably would have thought that I was just psychotic and imagining that somebody was on some phone. But nowadays, it's rare to be anywhere and not hear and see people using phones, technology, et cetera. But multitasking is really the number one enemy of mindfulness. It really does give people the false idea that they can do multiple complex cognitive activities at once when they really can't.
Is it impossible to be mindful while multitasking?
It's possible to be mindful. It's possible to be mindful if the tasks are mechanical and you can have kind of a meditative approach to them.
Give us an example.
Oh, one of the most famous meditation teachers came over here from Asia, and he worked in, and he was a you know, he was an immigrant and unknown, and he worked in a laundromat, and he would sweep the floor, and he would clean and do all these things while meditating, and he had this amazing calm about him, and I guess he was multitasking. He was doing many different things at once, but was really, whatever was going on in his head, he was very peaceful and obviously into what he was doing.
Matthew in Fairway, welcome to Central Standard and our conversation about mindfulness and multitasking as public enemy number one. Talk to us, Matthew. Matthew? We don't have Matthew. What should we tell our kids about multitasking? Dr. Lise, how important is it to tell them do their homework with the phone and TV off, focus on the work?
You're fighting a battle, a difficult battle to get kids to be different from their friends. Let's start out with the barriers to teaching kids to be mindful. There are so many distractions that are so much the norm, as you said earlier. To say to a kid you can't do that and that, most kids will look at the parent like they're crazy, but everybody else does, they say. The most important two things you can do with kids to get them to be mindful is to pay attention to them. Distracted parents raise distracted kids. So paying close attention to your kids and giving them labels for what they experience, especially emotions. Johnny, you look troubled. What's going on? Why do you look so upset? Or I'm so glad you're happy right now. I mean, that kind of attention where you give kids labels for what they experience, that's at the heart of meditation, is sitting quietly and concentrating, for example, on a phrase or on your breath, on breathing, and realizing when you're distracted and labeling the distraction and letting it go. That is the heart of most meditative techniques.
Talk about the role of distraction. Opponents of multitasking say useless information ends up being what your mind remembers, while the important information gets lost in the task. Is that true? And if so, how does that take away from you being mindful?
One psychiatrist wrote a book called Crazy Busy, and he describes multitasking as a mythical activity in which people believe they can perform two or more tasks simultaneously. So the research itself shows that concentration is just not what people think it is. It's a lot more work. There was a research study at Hewlett-Packard in collaboration with the University of London, and they found that workers distracted by email and phone calls. This is a great quote. I was looking forward to this one. Workers distracted by email and phone calls suffer a fall in IQ more than twice that found in marijuana smokers.
Wow.
Don't you love that?
I do.
It's just crazy. Twice what marijuana smokers experience.
So you can even double that if you are checking email.
Don't go there.
Right, right. And indulging a little
you're
bit.
You're four times worse if you're—
Four times worse, yeah. Exactly. How— aren't some of us better at multitasking than others, though? For instance—
It's an illusion. It's just an illusion.
It seems sometimes that women are hardwired, particularly women are hardwired to do multiple things at once. You talk about doing the laundry, changing the baby, running here, doing this errand, being on the phone.
It's an illusion because they aren't really, a lot of the things you just described really happen one after another. Nobody does laundry and changes a baby at exactly the
right.
same time.
Right. So that's not technically multitasking.
No, but what I think people who stay at home and raise children experience is just a very, very good, secure system where they know what they're doing next and they're able to go to it automatically. In fact, if you introduce something to somebody who does that, or a chef who knows exactly what, you know, when to put the French fries in the fryer. If you're working with somebody who has all that automatic behavior that all falls together well, and you introduce a new concept, or if somebody walks into the kitchen of the restaurant or the house and tries to talk to that person who's doing all that work, they probably won't multitask well. They'll probably seem distracted or drop the baby or something like that.
So what you're saying is if there is a system for process, then you can be mindful. But if there's no system in this quote-unquote multitasking environment, it takes you out.
Yeah, and let's take our discussion right now as a really good example where there's no way that concept can apply. You and I are both introducing new and different concepts to each other as we have this discussion. You ask a question, I don't know what questions you're going to ask me, and you don't know what answers I'm going to give. So we can't have a system. The best we can do in a system is a system of looking at each other, engaging each other. But down to content, I don't know what you're going to say. You don't know what I'm going to say. So if I were to try to do something simultaneously while talking to you, I couldn't. But, you know, if I know how to do the light laundry and the dark laundry by heart, memorized, I can keep doing other things that are also mechanical at the same time.
I'm going to blow your mind while I'm talking to you and take a call while I'm talking to you. Matthew, welcome back to Central Standard. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for taking my call. Love the show and love the topic.
Thank you.
Thanks, Matthew.
While living in Boulder, I just have a small tip for mindfulness during work hours. It's very easy, obviously, with the pace of life and being busy at the workplace to lose mindfulness, at any given moment. And while living out in Boulder, which is kind of a mecca for mindfulness, I was part of the startup, the social startup community, and I attended a meetup group where everyone kind of shared different tips and ideas on how to keep mindfulness. And this one fella had one that really stuck out to me, which was during work, every hour on the hour, they would have a gong noise that would permeate throughout the office. It was a small office, but it just reminded them to take a brief moment to be mindful of what they were doing and to remember to breathe and keep track of, you know, what's going on in their life at that moment.
You know, I've studied in a number of monasteries. I was at Zen Mountain Monastery in New York and have done several things. I actually got to go to something that the Dalai Lama did in San Francisco. And I don't know if you know this, Matthew, but those sessions do start out with gongs or chimes or something like that. So to start and end meditation, at least where I've studied these phenomena, they use them readily and regularly. So I still have some of those. They're just awesome.
Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you so much.
Frank, welcome to Central Standard. Frank?
Hello?
Hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Hi, Frank.
Okay. Here in Lawrence, University of Kansas, I actually took a course in mindfulness. It's simply a four-week, one-day-a-week community event that the psychology department puts on in mindfulness. I took in beginning mindfulness, and they have an advanced mindfulness. But one thing I mentioned during that particular course is kind of refuting your idea that if you're mindful, you won't have an accident. I was washing dishes once in a job I had, and I was being mindful of what I was doing as I was washing these dishes, and I had a very bad shock because I dropped the dish and it broke. And I thought, well, gee, if I'm mindful, how did this happen?
Yeah.
So I suspect that you can be mindful and still have accidents.
I'm smiling. I totally agree with you. That's, of course, the truth. And one problem might be that you're so mindful in what you're doing that something else that demands your attention gets in your way and you have that kind of accident. So how about this, since I agree with you completely, Frank, how about this? If you are not paying careful attention to what you're doing, there's a good chance that you'll get in trouble.
That's good advice for Frank. Thank you for calling. Talk about what matters. Baseball Hall of Famer and Kansas City legend Satchel Paige had a saying about mind over matter. If you don't mind, it don't matter. In being mindful, how do you focus on what matters? So you don't drop the plate like Frank. How do you focus on what matters?
You know, I have the good fortune of spending my entire career examining what matters in people's lives. And as a result, I look at my own life and decide what's important to me and what's not. I think what you're asking for me to reveal my value system, which is that what matters is trying to make sense of the world and why we're here, and what matters is loving well. So If you're doing a good job of trying to figure out where you fit in this world and what you can do to make your life meaningful, and if you love others well, you're all set.
Here's one ironic question. One of our regular listeners, Sergio, writes in, says he listens to Central Standard in KCUR because he feels like he's learning something new every time he listens, but he does it while at work. A lot of our listeners in this 10 o'clock hour, this strange, foggy 10 o'clock hour, do this while doing other things. Is that considered multitasking?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I would say that I can't remember the last time I drove my car or truck without having KCUR on. I mean, I just don't even remember it. So it's a pretty mechanical process driving with a routine and all that stuff. But I don't know what Sergio does for a living. I hope it's not brain surgery. If it's really, really, really complex and he's really listening to very complex concepts and ideas and is learning, both are suffering. But Sergio sounds like he's more engaged in listening to KCUR, so hopefully he doesn't do something that isn't pretty mechanical.
AJ in Liberty, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. My thought, I have a lot of friends and stuff. I'm, in my 20s, and especially during my teenage years, it seemed like I felt like a lot of people were trying to avoid mindfulness by being constantly, having the iPod on or constantly texting. And I think that a lot of people don't like just being able to feel, or they don't know how to recognize their emotions, and so they use all these distractions that we have to avoid that.
Thank you very much, AJ. AJ brings up a very, very vital and important and interesting point.
Oh, yeah.
People are avoiding being
mindful.
Oh,
yeah. In fact, one of the most important writers in this field is a psychologist named Jon Kabat-Zinn, Kabat-Zinn. He worked at the University of Massachusetts, still does, I believe, and put together a very, very, very good program for treating people who have sometimes catastrophic things go on in their lives, cancer, life-threatening illnesses. And an awareness of where you are and what's going on with you really amplifies that. So, the purpose of that program is to live in the middle of the catastrophe and figure out how to deal with it. And most of us, we want to be mindless. We don't want to think about our own suffering.
What AJ, our caller AJ, seems to suggest is that kids these days, or kids his age, or kids that he's familiar with, don't know how to do just one thing at a time or focus on one thing at a time. It's almost scary. Can mindfulness be scary?
Yeah, I'm scared every time I'm mindful about the amount of work I take on. When I think about the number of responsibilities I have in my life for all different kinds of things, it's scary. I'm sure it is for a kid similarly. We're all human. So what I do instead of being mindful about everything I have to do is I pick one at a time, and that's what I think people have to do to be effective. When you are scared by all the things that face you, pick the one that's important and stay very focused on it, and it will likely turn out well if it gets your full attention.
Talk briefly about the role of mindfulness in fear.
There are all different kinds of fear. Fear is the experience of getting physiologically activated or autonomically activated. Your central nervous system gets activated because there's something truly threatening it. That's what fear is. So, the proverbial lion in the jungle. If there's really a lion there, you're supposed to be afraid. Running across railroad tracks and suddenly hearing the ding, 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 ding as you go across it, which should scare you a little bit. The thing to do when you're in a fearful situation is to figure out what the threat is and mindfully resolve the problem so you don't get eaten by the lion or run over by the train. Anxiety is the same physiologic autonomic experience. You're activated, your palms are sweating, your heart is racing, all that stuff, but there's no real threat. And people who are overly focused on their own physiologic and psychological fear, their performance anxiety, for example, if you or I were supposed to start here at 10:05, and all of a sudden I started thinking, am I going to do well? Am I going to do well? Am I going to do well? Instead of being mindful about our conversation, if I was thinking about whether I was doing well or smart enough or whatever, that would really cause me anxiety. So mindful people, or the application of mindfulness where anxiety is concerned, is if you're really afraid of something, figure out what it is and mindfully figure out a solution or what the challenge is.
Dr. Bruce Lees is a professor of family medicine at KU. He's here discussing the concept of mindfulness in our daily lives. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we continue to discuss mindfulness as we explore the role of meditation in being mindful and procrastination and multitasking in the realm of being mindful as well. Meanwhile, Kansas City, what have you learned about being more mindful? How do you practice being more mindful in your day-to-day activities? What inspired that change? Do you multitask and still remain mindful? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Meditation philosopher James Baraz says, mindfulness is simply being aware of what's happening right now without wishing it were different, enjoying the pleasant without holding on to it when it changes, and it will, and simply being with the unpleasant without fearing it will always be that way, which it won't. We now continue our discussion with Dr. Bruce Lees, a professor of family medicine at KU, who's here discussing the concept of mindfulness in our daily lives. Kansas City, has not being mindful gotten you in trouble before? What's your trick for mindfulness? Can you concentrate and still get things done? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. Also, Facebook and Twitter are an option. On Twitter, our handle is @KCURCST. How are you mindful, Kansas City? Dr. Lees, you say being mindful is a trick for getting everything you want out of life. That's a tall order. Explain what you mean by everything you want out of life.
It is true, because if you're mindful, you will know what things you can and can't get out of life, realistically. And so you will curb those wants and desires that really won't happen. You will, instead of being left, you know, grasping for things that just won't happen. I won't be president of the United States. I won't be a brain surgeon. If I can get everything I want because I get to adjust what I want. And good solid mindfulness helps me decide, what do I want? It should be a deliberate process. People who are hungry for things they can't have are miserable. They're just miserable. So, yeah, being mindful, you can get everything you want as long as you know that you better decide smartly what you want.
Sam in Independence, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you very much. I have ADHD, I just sort of right now realized, from childhood. And even though I got my PhD in chemistry, I have had problem with that, and I failed in elementary school. And right now, because of the problem has caused me, being out of job, and also I was looking at all these problems to find out that, you know, I've caused a lot of problem for myself, and many times it makes me very depressed.
Sam is in Independence, Dr. Lees, and he's a PhD in chemistry, who mm-hmm. happens to have ADHD, and it's caused him some problems. Talk to him.
Well, let me just talk a little bit about what ADHD is for anybody who isn't familiar with it. The letters ADD stand for attention deficit disorder. It involves a cognitive deficit where typically a child at first, I mean, it starts early in life, as Sam mentioned, a child is unable to maintain attention to tasks that should hold their attention. And the ADHD is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. That's the difficulty attending plus a lot of behavioral hyperactivity. anytime anyone says they have attention deficit disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, I'm not skeptical, but I certainly have a lot of questions about who diagnosed it, how was it diagnosed. I am not an ADD expert who does all the testing and stuff like that at all, but I have watched my colleagues do the ADD testing. When it's done right, it is hours and hours over several days. It involves reports from teachers and family members and stuff like that. So not at all to be skeptical or deny anyone's report of ADD, but unless it was carefully diagnosed, I'd say it's only a tentative diagnosis in any particular person.
So what's your advice for Sam? Because it seems like it's counterintuitive. This man has a PhD in chemistry. That requires a major attention to detail and work and focus and problem solving in one sitting a lot of times. So
yeah,
describe that cognitive dissonance and help him out. What does he need to do? You need to get a better diagnosis?
If a person, the biggest factor in a psychiatric diagnosis, the biggest factor to look for is impairment. If impairment has occurred in interpersonal relationships, vocation, meaning work, in learning, in education, etc., if there's been impairment, then it's important for it to be carefully evaluated and treated. There are people who have lots of disorders that just overcome them by learning how to accommodate. So they may get no help from a professional. They just know, I have trouble in this situation. I'm going to do better. Here's what's interesting. There are all kinds of careers out there that require all kinds of skills and talents. To be a psychologist, I have to have a lot of interpersonal skills. I have to be able to read people's faces. I have to be able to listen to complex ideas and concepts, and I have to respond appropriately. I probably would be considered someone with attention deficit if you put a chemistry text. I have a PhD. If you put a chemistry textbook in my hand and said, "Why don't you read this?" and I'm going to talk to you about it later. As I tried to read that chemistry textbook, I would be distracted, terribly distracted, because it's not a part of my brain, my mind, my intellectual development that I've really cultivated. So, to the extent that we cultivate a strength or a skill cognitively, we're going to be good at it. We're going to be mindful when we approach it. If we haven't cultivated it, we're going to feel like we have attention deficit disorder. If I were just randomly an electrical engineer who spent most of my life with electronics, most of my life, not 8 hours a day, but if I was so fascinated by it, I went home and did it, etc., I might get so immersed in that when my kids came up to me and said, "Hey, Dad, Johnny's mad at me," I might not be able to attend to that interpersonal problem that my child is having, because it's not something I've developed. So it could well be that Sam has so brilliantly developed his chemistry mind that he just doesn't have the mind for certain other things that he hasn't developed his mind for.
What do you do about absent-mindedness?
I increase it every year.
You increase it? For instance, I lose my house keys probably about quarterly, and I'm not a very detail-oriented person. I walk off without crossing my I's and dotting my T's almost daily in what I would maybe consider mundane tasks or routine tasks that require a systematic approach to them.
Right.
Talk about that. Help me help myself.
I'll start by telling you how I do it for myself. I've too many things going on in my life. I won't list any of them, but I have so many things going on in my life that it is easy for me to do the same thing. It's easy for me to say, "Where are my keys?" I have been known to be talking on the phone and to turn to a friend, realizing my pockets are empty, saying, "Have you seen my phone?" I mean, and I've heard other people have done that too.
That happens to me all the time.
Okay, where's my phone?
I could do a pat the pockets dance when I come out of the house.
So because I am overcommitted, what I do is I tell myself, "Bruce, you're putting your keys down. You're putting them here on the dashboard of the car so that you see them when you get out of the car and when you see them when you get back in the car." I do things that I know. I try to take all the automatic things I do in my life that I don't pay attention to, and I try to pay a little bit more attention to them so I remember where I left them. I have a very busy shop. We work on boats. And I could somebody could say, could you help me with this? I could put the keys down on a vise in a very, very, very messy corner of the shop, get on to 3, 4, 5, 6 different tasks. And then believe me, then everybody in the shop has to run around looking for my keys with me because I haven't paid attention to where I left them. I just put them down mindlessly. So don't do that, Jabalani.
I will try not to. Zach from Lee Summit, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. I'll try to be brief with my question. There's a philosopher named Ken Wilber, and the guy you're speaking with seems to share some parallels, namely some exercises which seem to be fitted for the individual and their own strengths or weaknesses. For example, I wasn't always the most compassionate guy in the world, and I noticed that. So Ken kind of provided a contemplative meditative practice which really helps kind of develop or create space for compassion. So if we have these different strengths and intelligences, can we kind of customize that contemplative practice to evolve, or is it more of a wide net? How would one go about that?
This is an interesting thing that Zach brings up. What is thoughtfulness versus mindfulness?
First of all, I will say Ken Wilber is more than just a teacher and a writer. He was a pioneer in the field. So a good choice of an author to know about.
He talks about compassion. That's a different muscle than mindfulness, right?
Yeah. If you are mindful, let's do thoughtful and compassionate and mindful in this answer. To be thoughtful, I think, and I will get to compassion, to be thoughtful is to be considerate of others and to be caring towards others. It is, I think, the general understanding of that term is, you know, to care enough to, you know, hand somebody a tissue when they sneeze or say bless you or give them a pen when their pen runs out of ink and you can see that's thoughtful. Mindful is to be attentive to what's really going on around you. Mindful, you know, of the people suffering in the hot weather. Mindful of whatever. Compassion requires mindfulness. One has to get out of themselves and into the world or the worldview of another human being. I like to think of compassion as empathy plus caring. So let me break that down a little further. Empathy is different from sympathy. Sympathy is when somebody's hurting and you feel for them. Empathy is when you understand their pain. Sympathy isn't a really mindful way to be sympathetic to others, because when you're sympathetic to them, you're letting your own feelings get in there. Like, boy, she's sad and I feel sad too. So you lose your mindfulness. You lose that sharpness that you have when you really understand a person's pain without bringing your own pain into it. Compassion, as would be taught by somebody like Ken Wilber or whoever, compassion is the addition to empathy of caring. So, you know, when I think about those people with no electricity, the people whose homes have burned all in the past week, I don't feel sympathy. I don't feel pity. I don't feel suffering with them. I certainly can imagine the pain they have, and I do care. It can be really debilitating and distracting to be sympathetic. Again, sympathy is when you feel with the other person, and it's possible to care deeply without feeling another person's pain. This all requires mindfulness.
We got Reggie in Leawood. Welcome to Central Standard, Reggie.
Hey, how are you?
Pretty good. Go ahead.
Very nice conversation here. I was talking to the lady that let me talk to you. One of the things that I do that helps me out with meditation and being mindful is how, as a Jehovah's Witness, we meditate on Scripture. And so then, therefore, when we meditate on it, then you end up praying for understanding. And as you pray, it makes you mindful on the very thing that you're meditating on. So then you start to apply what you are learning from the Scriptures. And as you apply those things, you start to be more of a helpful person in society and pretty much in your whole aspect of life. So I really appreciate what you're talking about as far as meditation, because that's pretty much the basis of learning how to be mindful to the point to where you're actually able to function in a good way. But at the same time, I'm one of those guys who leaves his glasses on his head and can't find them.
Thank you, Reggie, for your contribution to the conversation on mindfulness we're having today with Dr. Bruce Leese. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org to join this discussion on mindfulness, which has kind of tapered into mindfulness and meditation. Speaking of which, Dr. Leese used to teach meditation. What did you learn from that experience? And how did it affect your practice with cognitive behavioral therapy?
I wasn't expecting that question, as I
no,
said
you
earlier,
weren't.
But I you asked me what I learned, so I'm going to answer that question. I'm pausing because it is a very personal thing, though it's not the kind of thing I can't say on air. You know, when I first started doing all the things I do in my life, I was pretty caught up in the material world, and all of my shirts had little horses on them with polo players, and they were all pressed, and they were all starched, and they were all in a line in my closet, and I had tassel shoes, and everything was just right, and I drove, I won't say the brand, but one of the more expensive kinds of cars, because, you know, I had to prove to myself that I was somebody, I guess. It's very interesting because I started teaching meditation to people, some of whom were homeless. I actually was teaching at Unity Temple on the plaza. I was also teaching at a local synagogue, all meditation. But after month after month teaching people who were addicted to substances, who were down and out, who were unemployed, really struggling, one day I walked out of Unity Temple here on the plaza. And I looked at my car. Okay, it was a black BMW. I looked at my car and I said, how could I? How could I be mindful of, you know, all the suffering in the world and get into this luxury without feeling cognitive dissonance? Now, that's not to say that nobody should have that car. It didn't feel like me anymore. So I was being painfully mindful throughout the entire experience of teaching meditation to people that are really suffering. And then I couldn't get into that luxurious car and feel right. And I sold it. I traded it in for an old used car from the BMW dealer. And so I learned that I can get along in life without all the things.
Simon in Lawrence, welcome to Central Standard.
Hello. My name is Simon. And I actually have a lot of comments that, I'll try to keep it brief, but a lot of things that you've touched on. I've actually, at the Unity Temple, they do Buddhist Recovery Network meetings there. And I about 6 years ago, I used a lot of mindfulness techniques to recover from alcoholism more recently.
Congratulations, Simon.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I actually used it to graduate from law school after being diagnosed with ADD. And I think it's very interesting that you mentioned the difference between mindfulness and compassion. For me, a lot of mindfulness has to do with me being compassionate towards myself and realizing my shortcomings.
Accepting them.
Right. Like you had been talking about if someone were to sit down with a chemistry textbook, which is definitely how I felt my first year of law school, you know, reading these things and just not being able to understand them. You know, I understood that everybody goes through that the first time. You know, everybody has a certain level of fear and just kind of be compassionate with myself, you know, and know that it's going to be okay as long as I apply myself and do what works for me in these situations.
Thank you, Simon.
Yeah, and congratulations again.
How does mindful relate to being present? Being mindful and being present, how do those two differ or relate?
One of my favorite meditation teachers in the whole world is a guy named Jack Kornfield. He wrote a book called A Path with Heart, and I'd strongly recommend it. And I'd strongly recommend the audio version of it because he's such a good teacher if you can get his and look for him. So Jack Kornfield, he talks about going into a casino and seeing a sign on the wall that said, "You must be present to win." And that was kind of his mantra, and I love that. I mean, the answer to your question is you got to be present to be mindful. You have to really be there where you are and not someplace else. You can't be in two different places at once, which is what multitasking is.
Can you be mindful without being present, but not present without being mindful? Explain
yes.
those things.
Well, the person earlier who was looking at their cell phone that I mentioned, they were present physically and 92% present psychologically, but and intellectually and emotionally. But people can read that other, even if it's 2 or 3%. We're better at reading the absence of somebody who's physically with us. We're pretty good at it. So so present is necessary for mindfulness.
So mindfulness is a spiritual concept. Can we really be mindful all the time, and should we be? Is there such a thing as too much mindfulness?
Yes. I think on this show we have talked at length about flow, the whole concept of flow, getting into something and kind of losing track of everything. You can certainly lose yourself in things and just enjoy the heck out of them and not be really concentrating on, you know, being in the moment. And that's perfectly legitimate. That's spontaneity.
Our listener Rudolph reminds us, speaking of spontaneity, of the StoryCorps motto, "Read Road Less Traveled" by M. Scott Peck. Listening is an act of love.
That is correct. And a few people have said that. Bernie Siegel, I think, is his name. He's a physician who's written some books.
And we're in radio, so that goes natural for us. Uh-huh. Listening is definitely an act of love here. And we love bringing you on. Dr. Bruce Lees is a professor of family medicine at KU, discussing the concept of mindfulness in our daily lives. And we thank you for joining in the discussion and checking us out today. Dr. Lees, thank you for coming.
It is always a pleasure.
And tune in tomorrow when we talk to a photographer about his work featuring Iraqi war refugees and learn about his own story as a child refugee as well. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi with help from Charlie Upchurch. Up to Date is next with the Political Pundits. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.